Breakthrough.
You are now listening to Breakthrough News.
Hello, everyone. I'm Rania Kalik, and this is Dispatches. It's been almost a year since fighting broke out between the TPLF and the Ethiopian government. As the war on the ground intensifies, so too does the war of narratives. Western nations, led by the U.S., have accused Ethiopia of every atrocity imaginable, from using rape and starvation as weapons to committing genocide, and they're threatening sanctions. The Ethiopian government insists that it's legitimately fighting a group that ruled the country with an iron fist for 30 years, and that this group is now trying to regain power through violence and terrorism with help from the West. So who's telling the truth? What explains the one-sided nature of the media coverage and of human rights organizations? How do Eritrea and Sudan fit into it all? And what's driving this U.S. policy that's alienating and destabilizing a longtime U.S. ally? To help make sense of it all, I'm once again joined by my Breakthrough News colleague, a fantastic journalist and the host of The Punch Out, Eugene Puryear. Eugene, welcome back.
Rania, thank you so much for having me. It's an honor to be here.
Well, it's so good to have you back on the show. And, you know, before we get started, I do want to let everyone know that we at Breakthrough News have covered Ethiopia quite extensively, including a lengthy discussion with you, Eugene, breaking down the history of the TPLF and how we got to where we are today. So I encourage everyone to go check that video out. It's a great primer. I've included a link to it in the description to this video. And then also a quick reminder that you can listen to every episode of Dispatches anywhere you get podcasts. And you can watch every episode on the Breakthrough News YouTube channel. Be sure to hit the subscribe button. And now to the topic at hand. You know, Eugene, last time that we covered this back in July, the Ethiopian government had just declared a unilateral ceasefire in Tigray, but the TPLF ultimately rejected it and continued to escalate, launching these offensives into neighboring regions. So I guess a good place to start would be, can you give our listeners and viewers a brief summary of maybe how this started and what we're dealing with on the ground now?
Of course. Well, you know, thank you for that question, Rania. I think it is important because we hear so much about Ethiopia, but there's very little context and very little framing. But I think the important thing to really understand here, and you've already laid some of it, is that, you know, the Tigrayan People's Liberation Front, which for 30 years from 1991 to 2018, or roughly 2018, ruled Ethiopia. And after 2018, the current Prime Minister, Abiy Ahmed, who was able to emerge actually from the coalition that TPLF had started, but they were so brutal and so corrupt, they were sidelined in their own coalition inside of their own country. Abiy Ahmed and others around him were able to search the leadership of that broader coalition and establish a new government. So in the time between 2018 and last year, what we see is that the TPLF, the Tigrayan People's Liberation Front, was becoming more marginal inside of the broader politics of Ethiopia. Now, their politics, which had been ethnically chauvinist in many ways, that had sidelined and, in fact, intensified some of the various ethnic tensions inside of the country of Ethiopia, was not able to really insert itself in any form of leadership role. And in the context of that, launched this war. And what took place was, like many countries, Ethiopia last year decided they were going to postpone their elections due to COVID-19. Now, the TPLF said, well, it has nothing to do with COVID-19. And in fact, they just want to consolidate their own power and it's anti-democratic and so on and so forth. And so they decided to launch an armed uprising against government forces and government military bases in the northern part, the Tigray region of Ethiopia. And that is how the conflict began. And the conflict has been going since then. And as you mentioned earlier this summer, there was a unilateral ceasefire that was declared by the Ethiopian government, the opening up of new humanitarian corridors. The TPLF completely and totally threw that away. They said, we're not going to have any sort of ceasefire, any sort of negotiations, and in fact, invaded the Afar region and invaded the Amhara regions of Ethiopia, which are neighboring regions of Tigray, and we'll get to that in just a little bit, in order to continue the war and to push forward their aims. So where we stand now in this conflict is really something close to the end game, I think is the best way to describe it. There, the rainy season in Ethiopia has ended, and that means that roads are more passable, skies are clearer. And so the ability of large military formations to move and also of air assets to be involved in some way, shape, or form in the fighting has increased dramatically. And certainly there has already been some skirmishing, airstrikes, artillery that is intimating the fact that there is almost certainly going to be more larger conflict. And what happens in that continued conflict, whoever launches an offensive first or counteroffensive, whatever it may be, it seems that the outcome of whatever this season, if you will, of fighting is, will determine very heavily what the outcome of the conflict is. So things could still go on for some time, but I do think we are starting to reach something of a denouement in terms of where the conflict is going and in terms of what's actually possible. So that's more or less where we are. I could say a little more about that. If there's specific things you wanted to ask, Rania, I could perhaps maybe explain a little bit more of the maybe geographic spatial realities.
Yeah, I think that'd be fantastic because I think, obviously with a lot of our listeners and viewers, they, probably aren't so familiar with the geographic layout, especially if they're Americans. We don't exactly get the best education when it comes to geography. So please, I feel free to give some, a brief explanation of what you're talking about physically.
Yes.
In terms of, yeah.
Well, I mean, probably the thing that people have heard the most of is that it's northern Ethiopia. And the first map I'll bring up is a map essentially of the front lines of the conflict and what things are going on right now. But if you think about Ethiopia on the map, and here you can see it here, this is the northern part of the country, the northern sort of, in the sense that the country goes a little bit like this, the northern part of that. And the green there that you can see, that is territory that's controlled by the TPLF. The purple that's just above it, most of that is Eritrea. And then some of the places that are shaded just below it are places where the Eritrean military is alleged to be. What's there in gray, those are the regional forces of the Amhara region that are affiliated with the Ethiopian government forces. And what I guess is a reddish color there, that is area that's controlled by the government. So it gives you a sense of what the sort of spatial realities are, not in terms of where the various states are, but in terms of where the front lines are in the context of the war that's going on now. And so I think that when you get some sense of that, it's worth also comparing that to the states themselves to give some sense of what's really at stake here in terms of the various sort of parts of the country. So we want to bring something up that is an actual map of the states. And you can see, so similar sort of overlay there at the top in the, I guess it's pinkish, that's Tigray, and the yellowish there, right to the side is Afar, and then just below it in the green is Amhara. And then you can see that light blue just below that, that's the Oromia region, and that's the largest, well, one of the largest regions, and the most people of Ethiopia are Oromia people. But you can see Addis Ababa is also, I believe, in that map as well. I think I can see it there. Sorry, I'm a little far away from the screen. But either way, you can get it there. But you can get a sense then now of one, that Tigray is relatively small. And I'll note that one of the features of this conflict is that the TPLF is claiming that a significant chunk of what you see there in the green, Amhara, is actually a part of Tigray. Now, this is a long-running conflict for some time. When the TPLF was in power, there was a larger subset of this was considered to be a part of Tigray. So this is, in and of itself, a major portion and element of the conflict. Maybe sort of some would say conflict within a conflict is not just that the TPLF has invaded the Amhara region, but they're in fact claiming a lot of it is a part of the, is actually a part of the Tigray region. So you get a sense there of northern Ethiopia, you get a sense of where the front lines are, and you get a sense, I think, of just sort of the broader regional arrangements that exist there in Ethiopia.
And again, I do encourage people after watching this video, because we're going to get into some of this stuff, but to really do go check out me and Eugene's last interview on this. Again, it's in the description. And Eugene goes very in depth into the history of the TPLF and then also what it is exactly that they want in this war, why they're fighting it in the first place, which is essentially to regain power after being pushed out, as you mentioned. But I want to get to an issue that has been a repeated accusation throughout this entire conflict. And that is the accusation that the Ethiopian government is intentionally preventing aid from making it into Tigray in order to cause a famine and to cause suffering, to weaken their TPLF opponents. And I mean, this is of course typical of a lot of wars. So it could very well be true that the government may be trying to prevent some aid from going in. I don't know, but we've heard this accusation throughout. But I also see accusations from the Ethiopian government that it's the TPLF who's to blame for blocking this aid and for actually stealing aid trucks to basically make the government look bad and to also try to like siphon it off to sort of fund their activities. It's not just the government saying this at this point. You know, this was kind of in the beginning, only the government was saying it. Nobody was taking it seriously because of the sort of one-sided coverage that we're seeing of this conflict. But more recently, we saw these accusations being made from some unlikely places. For example, USAID, which isn't exactly friendly to the Ethiopian government right now, very much pro-TPLF, actually came out and accused the TPLF of stealing their aid. And then you also have the UN, the United Nations, implying that there's something fishy going on with their aid trucks that go into Tigray, but then just disappear. And there's also an issue with fuel. And then, you know, meanwhile, you do see the UN and relief organizations reporting that the biggest obstacle to getting aid into these areas, not just Tigray anymore, by the way, but also, you know, there's many displaced people in Amhara and Afar who are also needing aid at the moment. And the biggest obstacle is actually the fighting that's making it unsafe to deliver aid. And this fighting has been, of course, caused by these TPLF offensives. But you know, very quickly, before I get your thoughts on the issue of, you know, who's blocking the aid, I do want to note, because this is important, that back in 2010, the BBC published an investigation. And if we could just pull up that article real quick, because I think it's important to just even see the headline. But the BBC published this investigation that found that during the infamous famine of the 1980s in Ethiopia, the TPLF siphoned off something like $95 million of aid to buy weapons for their fight against the government at that time. And this is not me saying this, you know, making this claim, or even the Ethiopian government now. This is a BBC report, you know, not exactly friendly to the Ethiopian government right now. And in that report, it even shows that a CIA assessment at the time said that, and I quote, some funds that insurgent organizations are raising for relief operations as a result of increased world publicity are almost certainly being diverted for military purposes. And they were talking about the TPLF. So it also kind of makes you wonder if it's possible that could be happening at all now, and given the historical record. And at the very least, you know, you can't, given this context, really blame the government for being concerned about that. So given all that, I'll let you go ahead and take the floor here on this aid issue.
Yeah, well, there's quite a bit there, and I'm certainly glad that you mentioned the nearly 2 million people have been displaced in Amhara and Afar, and, you know, quite a bit of what we're seeing. But anyway, we can get more into that, and I think it is worth talking about that when we compare sort of the two sides and what they're really doing and what they're being accused of. But I think the most important thing to consider when we're considering the aid issue is that it is undeniable that by escalating the war in and of itself, the TPLF obviously decided to use the issue of humanitarian crisis as a weapon of war. So we gave a little bit of this timeline, but I think it's important to remember this. So in early June, The Guardian, actually, out of the UK, published an article to this effect that was like, you know, international organizations, world organizations, something like that, call on Ethiopia to declare a ceasefire and open up a humanitarian corridor. And that was early June. Just a few weeks after that, the Ethiopian government declared a unilateral ceasefire, opened up a humanitarian corridor. And this is what, you know, this so-called international community at that time was calling on. They more or less complied. And so there is at least a brief moment there where it appeared like, okay, well, perhaps the fighting will die down and more humanitarian aid will be able to get into Tigray, which of course the TPLF has been holding out both then and now as their primary ideological point about this, that we are, you know, these great freedom fighters who are being blockaded and starved and aggrieved and so on and so forth. So you think they would seize the opportunity in order to get more aid into Tigray. But in fact, they did not seize the opportunity. And I think after, can't remember exactly how long it was, a couple weeks, let's just say, where it was unclear whether or not perhaps the ceasefire may be holding in sort of a de facto way, the TPLF launched two new invasions into surrounding regions. Now, as I mentioned with the Amhara region, there are sort of multiple issues at play there, including the territorial claim issue. With the FAR, it obviously was just an attempt to create more chaos and, if you will, quote unquote, the enemy's rear, areas controlled by the Ethiopian government, the main lifeline in terms of railways to ports. Ethiopia is a landlocked country. The main lifeline to the ports in Djibouti goes through a FAR. So, you know, an offensive there, people falling back, people fleeing, refugees, obviously put some stress as well on the Ethiopian economy. And the same could also be said of Amhara, right? You know, these are people who are in a region, the leadership of which is supporting the government. So obviously they are, you know, going to be making efforts to assist refugees and so on and so forth. So it just makes everything much more difficult for them. But on top of that, the one thing it absolutely guarantees is that it's going to be more difficult to get aid into Tigray. And, you know, aid workers, and rightfully so, I think from the point of view of aid workers, you know, have been raising this issue that we need unfettered access into Tigray for humanitarian goods. But I think anyone who has any experience and knowledge of wars know that in wars, there will never be unfettered access of just any and all goods, including things that can, in fact, be misappropriated for military purposes. And again, this is actually a very common thing that we hear in many conflicts across the country. I thought the point that you made there about that BBC article is very important because it goes to type. But when you're in this kind of conflict, and there's an issue of not just, you know, food, but food can also be diverted. Of course, fighters need to eat. Medical equipment, same thing. Fuel, same thing. Trucks, same thing. Money, same thing. Obviously, there's not going to be unfettered humanitarian access. So that's not to take a shot at aid workers, but it is to understand the mentality of the TPLF. They absolutely had to have known. There's no way they couldn't have known this. These are experienced people. They ruled a whole country. They've been involved in other invasions and wars inside their own country and destabilizing Somalia in conjunction with the Bush administration. They had to have known that this means that it'll be harder to get aid into Tigray. And what does that mean? And why is that important? And why am I saying they're using a humanitarian crisis as a weapon of war? Is the primary leverage of the TPLF against the government of Ethiopia is the narrative that these are beleaguered freedom fighters fighting for a just and righteous cause, and this evil government of Ethiopia is blockading them, starving them out, doing everything possible to destroy them, committing genocide and other human rights abuses. And that is the leverage which, of course, brings the international pressure to bear on the Ethiopian government from Western governments. Now, I think they have their own motivations, but just again, speaking to the narrative issue here, to create the narrative that the TPLF offensive, not defensive, offensive now, is somehow in relationship to some just cause, you have to create the perspective that there is some terrible crime going on. And the easiest way to create the perspective that there's some terrible crime going on is, of course, to be able to hold this humanitarian crisis, to be able to send out videos and things like that of young children, and absolutely tragic videos of young children who are malnutrition and things like are facing malnutrition and points of that sort. So I think that is the important context of this, is whatever else, and I do want to get into some of what's actually happening with the aid, but whatever else we might say about the aid, whatever else we might say about the accusations that are being made on the ground about what the Ethiopian government is or is not doing. The fact of the matter is, there was a unilateral ceasefire. There was the opening of humanitarian corridors. There was the opportunity for the TPLF to open up some form of negotiations, or at least just sort of de facto recognize the ceasefire and create better conditions by which aid could flow into the area. And instead, they escalated the situation, created a new humanitarian crisis in two other regions, and made absolutely certain that there would be a political or a politico-military situation that would mean that the humanitarian issues in Tigray would not be able to be 100% resolved, and that they could use that from a propaganda perspective. I mean, when you put all that together, I think it puts the onus first and foremost on the TPLF. I mean, the onus is really on them for starting the war in the first place, but I think it's an important context. So I'm sorry, go ahead. I was going to speak to some of the other points.
Please continue. I was just agreeing with you. I was nodding along aggressively.
Well, it's good to know at least I'm making some sense, at least to, you know, very smart, talented journalists. But, you know, I think that then the issue does become, though, some of the individual claims. And, of course, the biggest claim that has been put out there, Samantha Power, the head of USAID, has used it. The UN, until very recently, was using it, the so-called de facto blockade. Now, I already gave some context to the issue of unfettered aid, but there is quite an issue over what is actually happening in terms of the aid. Now, one thing that we absolutely do know is that since the unilateral ceasefire was declared, that aid has in fact been flowing into Tigray. There are two flights that come every week from the United Nations, from the capital of Ethiopia, Addis Ababa, to the capital of Tigray. There has been at least one, and there will be continuing EU flights that also have brought aid into Tigray. And there are hundreds of trucks that have moved into Tigray, carrying food, carrying fuel, carrying other forms of equipment, things that help with sanitation and other elements of that, and also carrying money because they are, you know, the aid workers are buying certain things to the extent that they're available to assist their operations and also to be able to pay the salaries of their own employees who are working with them so that those people are able to survive. So right away, you have to ask the question, well, if there's a de facto blockade, why are there all these routes of aid that are coming in? There's trucks coming in, there's planes flying in, all these various issues. Now, there's a subsidiary issue there that is related to what I put out in the context of unfettered aid, that of course it's not unfettered. So from the perspective of aid workers, certainly, you know, they want to be able to provide more aid to people, and they are also raising the issue of like, well, we need more aid to come in. Now, I won't go back to that issue, but I just want to link that to the context that I had earlier about unfettered aid, because that is really a lot of the issue on the ground now and where the UN has moved, which is in their most recent update, the OCHA, which is the office that oversees humanitarian affairs for the UN, they actually dropped the de facto blockade narrative, which they had just been using a couple weeks before. And they've now actually gone to a narrative that, well, there's just not enough aid coming in. And I think that those are two separate issues in a way, but I think it's an important walk back by the United Nations that was echoing the United States just a couple weeks ago in terms of what was happening there on the ground. And obviously, again, given this context of a war, the issue of unfettered aid is, it's not going to happen. There's going to be hindrances to humanitarian affairs. I think that's an important factor and knowledge for that. But be that as it may, that is what we know in terms of what's happening, what's going on, what's moving forward. There is, in fact, aid that is moving into Tigray. Now, there are some differences of opinion here. Now, there are accusations, there have been a number of accusations that the government of Ethiopia is holding up trucks on the main road that goes from Afar into Tigray, which is the main way that trucks are headed in there. Now, the Ethiopian government has recently announced, I believe this was 2 weeks ago, that they had reduced the number of checkpoints from, I believe it was 9, maybe 7, to 2. You know, a couple times they have addressed this issue of, you know, are there backups, and saying, well, you know, they're saying that we're holding it up, but, you know, there's no backups on the road. And then there's also, you know, something that we've seen just in the last few days from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, that they were essentially confirming what the UN had been noting, that there was some number, somewhere between 7 and 10 tanker trucks filled with fuel that were on the road ready to go from Afar into Tigray. Now, the UN, of course, used the language of awaiting government approval. But if the Ministry of Foreign Affairs is talking about it, you have to assume that approval is forthcoming. So even if there is an accusation that not enough aid is going in to Tigray, and to be frank, that some, again, makes sense given the context of what's going on from a conflict perspective. There is aid by land and by air going into Tigray on a regular basis now that is bringing in a range of different types of aid. So the idea of a de facto blockade doesn't make a lot of sense. This is, I think, why we saw the UN change their language, even though they are still saying many negative things about the Ethiopian government in some of the pieces that they've put out, or at least things that are sort of intimating negative intentions from the government. Obviously, the fact that they have walked back this idea of a de facto blockade, and just to be frank, almost every major UN organization that addresses these humanitarian issues has over the past several months made some positive statement about the Ethiopian government, their willingness to work, their willingness to engage in a discussion here. And so again, we have to understand the context of a conflict, and understanding that context, then look at what's happening. But there isn't a de facto blockade. I think that that in and of itself is just clearly not true. There is a limited flow of aid, but again, we're in the midst of a conflict. And again, this was something that was created by the offensive, created by the TPLF, that now, by the way, has changed their name to Tigrayan Defense Forces to sort of hide what's going on, that has not only massively stressed the humanitarian response of the United Nations, because now they're responding in three separate states, but also, again, has created a space, and I'm going to come to the issue of the trucks here, where they had to have known, and where anyone who's ever viewed any conflict ever would certainly understand this, that by escalating this conflict and putting themselves in a position where much of the aid could potentially be redirected, when they have a history of redirecting aid in other conflicts, as you've already pointed out, Rania, that it would make sure there is a limited flow of aid. So let me go here to the issue of the trucks and the issue of the fuel, unless there's anything you want to interject, Rania. I know I've been talking.
No, please.
Because I think that also speaks to the broader context. Now, this issue of the trucks going into Tigray, the aid trucks coming from afar through one road, has been a very fraught issue, but it's been an issue for some time. Now, we have to understand the reality. Is there any chance we could bring the front lines map up again? I know we didn't have that planned, but I think that actually might help people contextualize a little bit.
Let's do it.
What I'm about to say, because okay, so here it is. So again, the green is where the TPLF has control. So you can see they're surrounded by other forces on all fronts, that they have no access to any ports, no access to any international borders. And so the only equipment and material that they could possibly have is A, things that they pre-stockpiled prior to starting the war. And there have been some, what I certainly view as credible allegations and statements, including them doing some military parades, that they were stockpiling it. But okay, let's just say they don't have anything stockpiled, or it's, you know, limited. It's been going for some amount of time. They obviously have no clear route for a major resupply to come into the country. And they have themselves already started two offensives, and they have said that they're willing to do as much as march to Addis Ababa and march to Asmara, which is the capital of Eritrea, and try to overthrow both governments at
Jesus
the same
Christ.
Time. If you look even at what they're putting out in their own media, right, it is quite ambitious, but what they're putting out in their own media, they are, you know, recruiting many soldiers and, you know, continuing to fight. They have rejected, and we can talk about this a little bit later, but I do think it's relevant. They have rejected every single form of mediation that realistically is going to happen. They've totally rejected African Union mediation, and they certainly are attempting to leverage the humanitarian issue to bring the United States into a negotiating process. And again, we could talk more about that a little bit later, but just to put all of this in context. So then how are they going to move people around? How are they going to feed their fighters? How are they going to fuel their offensives? This is modern warfare. How are they going to take care of their wounded and so on and so forth? Where are those supplies really going to come from? Now, we certainly know from USAID that they, who themselves, as you noted, are no friends of the Ethiopian government. I noted the head of it, Samantha Power, has been one of the most critical international voices towards the Ethiopian government and one of the most one-sided out there, although she's made a couple other statements. But I say all that just to say they themselves, as the TPLF, have already ransacked aid warehouses. But I can't say 100%, but you certainly can surmise that the easiest way to get trucks, to get fuel, to get medical supplies, to get food, in order to make sure that you have the military capacity to fight what almost certainly will be a multi-front conflict, to potentially escalate said conflict, which you've intimated you would do several times, especially when you are refusing to negotiate and in fact have totally rejected the main root of negotiation, the African Union. I think the obvious summation, or the obvious thing that you would surmise there, is that they are taking aid and using it to bolster their military capacity. Now, again, I can't say I have inside information, but this is what brings us to the UN talking about the trucks.
Right.
So the UN issues this very cryptic tweet, because the Ethiopian government has been making this allegation about the trucks for months. And of course, it was just being dismissed. International media was refusing to pick it up. It was just something that was just being sort of set out there in the ether. And only those of us who were paying close attention to the conflict itself knew that it was out there. So the UN, this is a few weeks ago, puts out a very cryptic tweet, which is just a picture of a bunch of trucks. And it says X number of trucks have gone into Tigray, and like none of them have come out, and the trucks need to be returned. And that was it. And so, of course, the first thing that you think,
if you're trucks.
Right, exactly, right? Like there's all these people who have been saying, hey, they're stealing trucks. And then all of a sudden the UN is like, where are our trucks?
And so Jesus. Well,
there it is. Now, the thing to understand about the trucks is the trucks are actually commercial trucks, and they are companies that are contracted out by the United Nations, by and large contracted out by the United Nations, to send these trucks in with the aid, to meet up with the aid workers, not just from the United Nations, from other organizations that are also working there. from other organizations that are also working there in order to be able to carry out the work, to be able to carry out the aid relief. So anyway, long story short, once this has come out, now the TPLF is on the hot seat, right? Because there's all these allegations that they've stolen the trucks, and now the UN, and you know, the way UN, the UN speak, and I think people who follow conflicts around the world know how this can be, is that the United Nations, you know, they work pretty much with every country, people from every country are working in the United Nations, so they rarely are making, you know, huge sweeping statements about like who's doing what. Sometimes they are, but especially in humanitarian relief, they kind of oftentimes we'll try to soft pedal it a little bit. I say all that just to say that even though the tweet was a little cryptic, it was quite clear. So the TPLF had to respond. And what the TPLF started to say, and then the UN, by the way, started to parrot this after the tweet, which leads us to another issue I think we can get to, which is situation in the UN. But they start saying, well, the real issue is that there's no fuel in Tigray. And so the trucks are coming in, but they can't get back out. And that the drivers are scared because there's so much harassment on the one road from Ethiopian soldiers. So I said immediately, okay, you know, prima facie, not a lot of fuel. Let me like look into this. I don't want to just dismiss it out of hand. But when you look at the UNOCHA report, and this report is consistently updated, you can find it, you know, if you go to their Twitter, they're tweeting it out a lot and they're updating it. And it's a whole situation of the humanitarian thing. There's a lot of great graphs and visualizations to help you understand it and all these other pieces. One of the things that really caught my eye was that when this controversy first broke, when the truck issue first came, when it came to the issue of the distribution of food, which was the principal issue among other things, but let's just stick with food here. The graphic said that there were 50 days worth of fuel, and this is like late September, is September 1st, that it was as of September 1st. There's 50 days worth of fuel, but 0 days worth of trucks. So intimating that we had enough fuel, but we didn't have the trucks to deliver food to those who needed it in terms of humanitarian relief. Now, when you think about it like that, it really explains the tweet. Because ultimately, they weren't trying to raise an issue about fuel. They're trying to raise an issue about the trucks and bring attention to the fact that the trucks were potentially being diverted. Now, on the issue of the road, you know, and this is also interesting because in the most recent update, several of the things about the fuel, they've kind of gone back on a little bit, and the UN, that is. And certainly the one thing that caught me about the road has been completely removed from their statement as of a couple of days ago when I looked at the most recent update, which I think was from October 6th. And that statement was that the road, the one road between Afar and into Tigray was calm but unpredictable. And that also caught my eye because I said, well, wait a second. If all of the drivers of hundreds of trucks are so terrified that they don't want to go on the road, that doesn't actually sound calm or unpredictable. It sounds like it's the opposite of calm and that outcome is completely predictable. So right there were two very clear discrepancies with the explanation for what was going on with the trucks. Now, again, I'm not there. I can't say 100% what's going on with the trucks, but what seems very clear is that it isn't an issue of there being zero fuel. There is probably not as much fuel as they like, maybe not enough fuel. And I believe that October 6th update, they said there's 22 days of fuel left for food distributions. And I want to come back to the fuel issue in a way, but that the issue wasn't fuel when the TPLF was claiming it was fuel. There is the issue of whether or not people were being harassed, robbed on the roads. I'm not saying that didn't happen to anyone. I'm not saying it's not a factor. But again, the actual UN description of the state of the road did not actually jibe with the discussion about how dangerous the road allegedly was. When you put those two things together, it lends quite a bit of credence to the idea that in fact what took place is that a number of the trucks were in fact diverted for other purposes that I can't say what they are, but certainly it seems very likely that they could have been military reasons, because you put all this together and it all starts to make one clear narrative around what, yes, are accusations, but the circumstantial evidence surrounding them seems to go very much in this direction. And the second thing I'll say about this is an issue about fuel. Now, this is also something that dropped out of the most recent update of the United Nations. I don't know, maybe the TPLF is reading what I do and noticing, you know, my podcast, The Punch Out, and changing their strategy. I don't know if I'm that influential.
They must be.
But this drops out of the UN report was an issue of the Tigray authorities and fuel. So in the update, like before this update, the one where they were still saying there was 50 days worth of fuel left, the UN this is maybe an early, slightly earlier October update. The UN had stated that the government of Tigray had stopped selling them fuel due to quote unquote shortages. Now that also made me take a step back because I said, well, wait a second here. So what you're saying is that, because shortages doesn't mean none, it just means that you don't have a lot. So you're right. Saying that the government of Tigray has fuel and is holding it, hoarding it, you could say, given what everyone is, what the TPLF is saying, given what the UN is saying. If I am to believe all of them, this is one of the worst humanitarian crises on the face of the planet right now. And you're telling me that in that moment, the TPLF goes to the humanitarian groups and says, we will no longer sell you any fuel for these critical humanitarian operations? Well, what could be more critical than the humanitarian operations if it's what people are saying? Well, the only thing about that that could be more critical is war, right? And the only sort of subsequent issue you could raise is the commercial sales. Maybe they're trying to make a lot of money off the sale of the gas. But then you have to ask yourself again, if this is some huge humanitarian crisis and the TPLF is claiming, well, you know, we're doing everything we can to save the people of Tigray. Well, why are there even commercial sales of critical goods that are needed for humanitarian deliveries? Why are they not just giving the fuel to the United Nations, giving the fuel to those who need it in order to conduct these aid operations? Well, again, whether you look at the issue of are they hoarding fuel for a conflict or are they taking advantage of the sort of economics of a siege, if you will, and trying to profit off of the fuel by price gouging the United Nations and other organizations or whatever it may be. But again, they cease to sell it. So, I mean, they could be doing both, operating off price gouging and then deciding they wanted to hoard it. But you put the trucks together with the fuel issue and the broader geographical context. Remember that I laid out for people about how isolated the region really is in terms of ability for major resupply, from a military perspective, major resupply. Then again, it lends a huge amount of credence, in my view, to the fact that something dodgy is going on and that it almost certainly is related to military preparations by the TPLF in order to be able to carry on the conflict and potentially expand the conflict into both other parts of Ethiopia and into the nation of Eritrea.
Well, you know, so much of what you say actually like makes me think of Syria, because there was a lot of this sort of same back and forth accusations. And then, of course, it was such a one-sided conflict in terms of the narrative that, you know, the rebels, if you will, had the upper hand and anything they said was just echoed, despite the fact that it was very obvious and ultimately proven that they were hoarding aid and they were hoarding food and then selling it at obscenely high prices to the people that, you know, they claimed that the government was starving and so on and so forth. But, you know, moving on to the issue of atrocities, right? Because, you know, in the initial phases of the conflict, when it was kind of just isolated to Tigray, human rights abuses were mostly blamed on the Ethiopian army, as well as, you know, Eritrean troops got a lot of the blame for that. We can go into that in a bit, as well as the Amhara militia. And these abuses included things like massacres and of Tigrayan civilians specifically, and ethnic cleansing of Tigrayans, and this, you know, widespread use of rape as a weapon of war. But since the TPLF recaptured most of Tigray after the unilateral ceasefire and then launched its subsequent offensives, they have, you know, increasingly, not as loudly, though increasingly been accused of a spate of atrocities in both Amhara and Afar. Though these, of course, these atrocities haven't received as much attention as they should. And I want you to go into some of the things that they're being accused of doing in these regions. But first, I also just want to note that we're also getting more reports of things that now that they're in charge of Tigray, atrocities that they might be committing. And one accusation that I've seen repeatedly brought up by people who are very much opposed to what the TPLF is doing is the accusation, but for whatever reason, you know, the media has shown no interest whatsoever investigating, is the use of child soldiers by the TPLF, as well as forced conscription. And of course, these two things are related. And of course, rather than look into this, we've actually seen the media cover for it in a really bizarre way. And I want to show one example of what I'm talking about. This is one example among many. If we could pull that up real quick. So this is one example among many. This particular Instagram photo that you see, the screenshot, is a screenshot of a photo that was taken by the New York Times photographer Finbar O'Reilly and was included in a piece that was really glorifying the TPLF. It was written by their very white Africa correspondent. Well, I think he's white. He sounds white. Declan Walsh. It sounds like a very white name. If it's not, I apologize. But I feel like it's safe to assume it is. But the reason, and this is, of course, appears on Jeff Pierce's Medium page. He's written many excellent posts kind of like debunking some of the narrative that we're hearing on Ethiopia. And the reason I show this in particular is it was actually initially included in the New York Times piece that was written sort of like as an advertisement for the TPLF alongside many other photos. And this one, this is what it said in the New York Times piece that Finbar includes in his caption is a scrappy force of local Tigrayan recruits. That's how it opens. Mm. Now this, if you can scroll up a little bit so we can actually see the photo, this is not a scrappy force. These are children. Like, there's no other way of looking at this photo. Those are children. Those are like children that look maybe between the ages of 9, perhaps a little younger, and up. I mean, even if it's just like really small teenagers, they're still children. It's pretty obvious. And it's not the only thing. I mean, we've seen, there's been footage, and Jeff collects it in this article, sort of footage that's been shown of like what are clearly children carrying weapons for the TPLF. I mean, these are child soldiers being glorified again as like some scrappy force of local people who got together. And I just thought that was one important example to show visually. But I mean, what do you think about this, Eugene? What do you think about the way that the media has covered atrocities, especially now that there's no question that the TPLF is committing them in Amhara and Afar? And maybe can you talk about some of those atrocities?
Yeah, well, and I want to just first and foremost underscore the point that you're making, that there is actually no question that the TPLF is committing a number of atrocities, and literally every actor in the conflict, including those that are other than the TPLF, by the way, and I'll get to that, but literally every other sort of force, whether it be the United States, the United Nations, Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, have all absolutely confirmed that the TPLF is, whatever else they're saying about anything else, they have in fact confirmed that the TPLF is committing atrocities. So I think it's important to note that. And I think we have seen more, you know, AFP and others have been doing more. I also want to mention, since you mentioned Jeff Pierce's blog there, Jamal Countess has a recent piece. He's a Getty Images photojournalist. He has a recent piece there relating his conversations with internally displaced people from the Amhara region that also, you know, collects some testimonies there regarding the child soldiers, but also regarding some of what took place in terms of atrocities. But I want to say, in terms of the media's coverage, and to speak to that, I think another framing question, because again, you know, we're dealing with an issue that I think framing and context is critically important. Because in any war and in any conflict, there are terrible tragedies, terrible things that are done, and you know, really unspeakable issues that happen to civilians. I mean, this is the nature of war. It's why war in and of itself is so execrable and why it should really be avoided at any and all cost, I think, when we're thinking about principles of humanity. But taking one step back again to the media coverage, let me not get too carried away here. The context of this, I think, is critical for people to understand, is the context of accountability. Now, no matter what the accusation is of the TPLF, no matter what the evidence, no matter who is putting it out there, it's always fake and it's always untrue. They say every single thing about them is not that it's fake, it's false, it's distorted, that there's staging of things, like every single thing, it's not real. Now, that's certainly one position you can take. Now, you look at the government of Ethiopia, that has, of course, gotten the vast majority of accusations here. Like, I mean, most people who are mentioning the TPLF, it's like a slight little footnote that the TPLF is in any way, shape, or form, you know, involved. And so the Ethiopian government, again, who's gotten the bulk of the criticism here, the Attorney General of Ethiopia has, in fact, tried dozens of soldiers for war crimes already. The Ministry of Foreign Affairs has actually, in fact, already in conjunction with that investigation, openly stated that there have been things that they would consider war crimes that they want their own, you know, governmental members to be held accountable for, and that they'll continue to investigate. The Ethiopian Human Rights Commission, which is headed up by a former political prisoner who was returned to the country when Abiy Ahmed started to open up more of the democratic space in the country after he becomes prime minister. The Ethiopian Human Rights Commission, which is also working with the United Nations right now, have themselves also stated that they have seen things that they consider to be not in conformity with human rights in terms of the conflict on their own side, and, you know, continue to report that. So on the one hand, you've got one side that, no matter how well documented, is saying we never do anything wrong ever and we're totally pristine. And you have the other side that is certainly raising concerns. And I mean, they've certainly, the Ethiopian government, pushed back on a number of claims from Amnesty International and others and said this is either not what happened, it didn't happen, or it didn't happen the way you say it did. But they've also said, but we're not saying that nothing is happening. And in fact, we are saying that we are going to hold people accountable who have engaged in some of these things. Now, some people could say it's a fig leaf. You can say they're not going far enough. You could say they're not doing enough, or whatever it may be. But when you're talking about the narrative in the media around this, when you have one side that is willing to admit, yes, we've done some things wrong and we will hold some people accountable, and another side that, no matter what, is saying we never do anything wrong and we never do anything bad and everything that's said about us is a lie, you would think that just off the rip, that would introduce more even-handedness in terms of the way things are reported, and that perhaps the Ethiopian government may gain a modicum of a benefit of the doubt from the international media when they're questioning some of the claims, that the international media might follow up on some of the questions that have been raised by the Ethiopian government about the nature of individual circumstances, that they may respond to some of the issues around methodology that have also been discussed in the context of this report. But instead, you don't get any of that. And everything that's reported is basically like the Ethiopian government is the worst, committing every crime in the history of crimes in the history of the earth. And the TPLF, maybe they did something at some point, but it's always more couched in the issue of accusations and things that people are saying and things that people have heard. And so you'll have the exact same type of evidence. You'll have people interviewing refugees from a place and saying, this is what they told me and this is what happened. And when it's the Ethiopian government, it's 100% true. And when it's the TPLF, then they're just accusations. And you can see that all the time in terms of the coverage of what's going on. So, you know, taking one step away from, I think, the issue of individual incidents, I think, is the issue of the context and the framing and the narrative and the fact that the government of Ethiopia is being, in my view, demonized for many of the same behaviors that can be seen from the TPLF, who is not being demonized about it. And that, to me, suggests that the media, international media, is not, in fact, interested in giving people the correct context, which is critically important, right? Because people are being asked in the United States to sign up to the possibility of a sanctions regime that could result in 1 million lost jobs of Ethiopians, among other terrible things, on the basis of these claims that are being made. So the nature of the claims and the context of them are very, very important. So again, when you have one side that is willing to admit they do some things wrong and another one that is just fantastically suggesting that they've never done anything wrong in history, it seems, then I think you have to start to say that there is something going on with the media narrative here, where there's people putting their thumb on the scale for a certain type of agenda, an agenda that's going to demonize the Ethiopian government and set it up for sanctions and set it up to be even more internationally isolated because of these claims that are being made. Because the reality is, if people were talking about the fact that the TPLF is raising villages, that they've conducted their own massacres, that they, in fact, you talk about de facto blockades. Well, look at what the UN says about places like North Wolo in the Amhara region that are under definite blockades by the TPLF, and the UN themselves is saying they can't even get humanitarian aid in there. So they're raising villages, they're massacring people, they're at least potentially, it seems to me logically, using child soldiers. They have been accused by the United States government of diverting aid. They're also acting in a way that has escalated the conflict at every turn and sought in every possible way to not have any form of diplomacy. Well, if people really knew that, they would view the issue that very differently. And I think they would view the perspective of the government of Ethiopia very differently, because the context they would have would be very different context. But right now, all they get is demonization context. And I think the media has been deeply, deeply complicit in that fact. Some of them seem to be acting in a very activist way to sort of push things forward in a way that will create confusion about what's going on. And no matter how poorly claimed, if it's about the Ethiopian government, you can get it in the mainstream media. Where the other side, of course, as I've already mentioned, no matter how well sourced, it's always just quote unquote accusations. So I think we really have to ask what's going on in the major newsrooms all across the United States and all across Europe, that some of this basic facts, some of this basic context, and some of this basic framing is getting completely lost. And I think also, and this is the final thing I'll say on this, that vis-a-vis the relationship between the TPLF and the government of Ethiopia, where one question here is the TPLF is basically saying we are the best people on earth and, you know, we are unfairly sidelined in our own country and essentially basically saying by force, we are trying to force our way back into the leadership of the country or significant leverage of it, then I think you would want to get some sense of, well, like, who were they, in fact, and what would their return actually mean, which is, again, why I think this issue that I've raised multiple times, and I've raised it multiple times in my podcast, and I think maybe some people think I'm harping on it, about the fact that the Attorney General of Ethiopia has charged and, you know, I think actually convicted dozens of soldiers of what they deem to be crimes in the field of battle, that the Ethiopian Human Rights Commission has, in fact, been speaking out against the Ethiopian government, that the Ministry of Foreign Affairs has actually made statements that they are not endorsing what all soldiers have done at all times. I mean, you could certainly add many other things to that around the elections that we recently saw. I won't get so deep into that. But when you put those two things together, that, well, one side of the country ruled the country for 30 years under an iron fist where they were deeply kleptocratic and committed huge amounts of human rights abuses, as was well recognized at the time, and destabilized neighboring countries. The other side, and there are many things we could say and many conflicts, and maybe we'll get into a little bit of the Ethiopian government, seems to have at least opened the door to a very different set of policies, brought back political prisoners, opened up the democratic space to where the Ethiopian Human Rights Commission can critique its own government and where the Attorney General of Ethiopia doesn't have to fear, you know, being cracked down on by charging soldiers. Well, that seems like there is a difference between these two forces that is also important contextually, again, in what American people, and I'm talking to you from the United States, are being asked to sign up to, which is a regime potentially of sanctions where as many as 1 million Ethiopians could lose their jobs if the U.S. Pulls Ethiopia out of AGOA, and where it could get very even worse, as we've seen Venezuela, Iran, and others from a humanitarian perspective, if sanctions start to come in any significant way. Well, if you're going to be asked to have that done in your name as a United States citizen, it would seem that, you know, the varying records of the two entities and their willingness to have some level of openness to critique on this issue of human rights should speak to some degree about the agenda of both sides and about how I think the U.S. push and the U.S. contradictions here show that they have no actual concern for human rights in the United States. And in fact, is just also similar to the TPLF, trying to manipulate the issue to gain a geopolitical outcome.
So, on to build off of what you're talking about, I think it's a good moment to kind of briefly go into the, you're talking about juxtaposing the current government with the TPLF. And there is a new government that was just, I guess, elected. Abiy Ahmed was just sworn in for a new 5-year term. And it's quite an inclusive government, which is an argument that you've made. And I'll let you go into what you mean by inclusive government, because the way it's been portrayed in the media is quite the opposite. Could you maybe talk about why you think this new government is inclusive, particularly compared to the TPLF that, again, like you mentioned, was in charge for 30 years. And then maybe, to kind of add this on to it, because this is also juxtaposing who's in charge now versus who was in charge, is, speaking of demonization, Abiy Ahmed has been quite demonized after being, beloved in the Western press. He won a Nobel Peace Prize. To now you see these articles like written over and over, like what went wrong, how Abiy Ahmed went from great to awful. Like, I mean, I'm paraphrasing. That's essentially the idea you get if you look up his name in headlines. So when it comes to the economy, aside from also maybe the inclusiveness of the government, one of the arguments I've seen made by some people who might call themselves leftists in the West is they've described the TPLF as having had a socialist economic development policy, as being Marxists, whereas they describe Abiy Ahmed as being a neoliberal. So on top of maybe comparing the two governments, how would you classify the economic policies speaking of the TPLF versus Abiy Ahmed now? And would you agree with that narrative that the TPLF was socialist in its development policies versus Abiy Ahmed, the neoliberal?
Well, two good questions, the political and the economic there. I mean, starting with the political, I mean, you know what, we're going to have to see how inclusive the government is ultimately in terms of, you know, what the ministers themselves do. But I think it was notable. It was not subtle. I mean, it was very clear what they were attempting to do by bringing in some opposition members. And, you know, I think it's also worth noting here that there is essentially nobody questioning the fact that Abiy Ahmed and the Prosperity Party have a significant amount of support in the country, and that whatever the other criticisms that can be made of the elections by certain forces, and I'll come back to that in a little bit, that really the elections absolutely reflected the fact that all across large swaths of the country, there's significant support for the Prosperity Party and so on and so forth. So I just wanted to note that, you know, even many of the Western press who have been aggressively criticizing the government of Ethiopia and their arguments about the elections, they have not been making accusations that the elections are stolen or that they're, you know, whatever it may be. I mean, people are, you know, ultimately saying, yes, this was a big landslide victory. When you look at a lot of the photos from the elections, you can sort of see that quite a number of people were participating. So I just wanted to say that because I think it also speaks to sort of one of the core issues here, which is the issue of the political marginalization of the TPLF inside of the country. But one of the things that was done when the new cabinet was announced, and perhaps the most notable, is Dr. Nega, who is from a group called the Ethiopian Citizens for Social Justice. It's a smaller party that did win a few seats, but he's a known figure. He became the Minister of Education in Ethiopia. Now, I have to say, it definitely lifted my eyebrow up because Dr. Nega, who also, by the way, is a former professor at Bucknell University here in the state of New York, he has a long history as an opposition leader. Now, to give some context, the most recent elections that happened are basically considered the first quote-unquote free and fair elections since 2005. Now, in 2005, the TPLF, almost everyone thinks the TPLF lost the election. And the leader of the opposition coalition was Dr. Nega, who's now the Minister of Education. Now, what the TPLF did at that time is they launched massive repression, especially against protests by students that were calling out the fact that the election had been stolen. They shot people down in the streets with live ammunition. There was a huge crackdown. And of course, they then brought their coalition, the TPLF-led coalition, back into power, even though it seemed pretty clear that they had not won the election. Also worth noting here that when Barack Obama went in 2012 to Ethiopia, he made a big point of saying how they were quote unquote democratically elected, despite this fact. Now, putting that aside, the current Minister of Education, you know, he was in America for some time. Then he became the leader of an armed group, Jinbat 7, that was based in Eritrea and that was playing a major role in opposing the TPLF. And TPLF is gone. He starts this, with others, this new political party, and is then brought into it. But it's obviously a clear sign, you know, to the people of the country and also to the international community and people who know about Ethiopia that they've brought someone who has a long history, not only of opposition political activity, but who was, in fact, one of the key figures in the last similar style of election, which they probably won and which was stolen by the TPLF, that obviously the Prosperity Party and Abiy Ahmed, the prime minister, are trying to send the signal that they are, in fact, more inclusive than the TPLF. Now, the Prosperity Party is essentially the former coalition that the TPLF had around it when they ruled. And as I mentioned earlier, they were sidelined inside of that coalition after a range of protests, particularly from the Oromo people, but also other parts of the country, other activity that it just showed they were sort of losing their grip more or less. And others inside of their coalition were able to emerge. Abiy Ahmed becomes the prime minister. So in the context of this, and as you mentioned before, Rania, we talked quite a bit about this in our last conversation about Ethiopia. So I don't want to go super, super deep into this, but I do think it's an important context. You know, Ethiopia is a country with a very diverse and rich ethnic history and background. And I think it's important for people to recognize that there are a range of issues that go back many, many, many decades around, certainly for the past, let's say, 50 years, around the issue of, and Ethiopia, of course, you remember, was an empire under Haile Selassie. And his family before him, and that there were a lot of issues, of course, of one ethnicity, the Amhara, being the most dominant ethnicity. And there have been a lot of issues around the distribution of resources, the distribution of opportunity. The TPLF, of course, was saying when they came into power that they were going to address these things. But in reality, they seem to have just adopted sort of their own, you know, sort of self-promotional perspective. So there's a lot of issues, and I can't get into all of them here regarding how exactly the state should be structured. And of course, this is not just a question of Ethiopia. This is a question of basically every multi-ethnic, multinational state anywhere on earth, really. Many of them have addressed this issue. How are resources going to be equitably distributed? How are opportunities going to be equitably distributed? How are you going to address the historical issues of marginalization of certain communities? What does that mean vis-a-vis those who were doing the marginalization? And, you know, who gains, who loses? How's that determined? How's that measured? How's the pie divided, essentially, right? And what Abiy Ahmed has been putting forward, and this also has a long history in Ethiopia, is that the sort of TPLF way of addressing things, which is sort of hyper-federalism, and in their, to actually call it hyper-federalism is wrong. They were deeply centralized, but on themselves. But presenting a perspective that you should have sort of all the different ethnic groups have their own political parties and try to share power between them, and it's a longer story than that. But what Abiy Ahmed has been saying is, we should have one political party of Ethiopians that recognizes the ethnic diversity of the country, the various ethnic heritages of the country, and the histories of all of these various regions, but where we're trying to develop the state and develop the capacities of the country in order to increase the size of the pie by which one could be divided and make sure the division is equitable, because we're sort of all, you know, at the same, we're all rowing in the same direction, so to speak. And so the Prosperity Party was the collapsing of all the various ethnic parties that had been a part of this coalition that Abiy Ahmed was a part of into one political party, promoting more of a, I don't want to say more of a centralized politics, but more of a national politics or a politics of national unity is what I should say, over a politics of division. And certainly this is something that is also spoken to by some of those, certainly from the Ethiopian Citizens for Social Justice and others, in terms of the direction of the politics of the country. Now, there is a lot more to be said about that. I mean, obviously, you know, you look at the issue of the elections and the ONLF, which was one of the large armed groups in the Somali region, which returned from their bases in Eritrea and, you know, put down the gun to participate in the process. They did not participate in the most recent round of elections. They have called for more efforts for national reconciliation and national unity, different and broader frameworks for national reconciliation and national unity. But notably, they said, we remain committed to a peaceful path to resolve these issues. So you've even seen from elements of those who are critical of the government that they don't want to do what the TPLF did and pull the country apart. But the reason I said that I think the government is more inclusive is basically that, right? Is that, again, we'll have to see. I mean, we'll have to see how the different ministers are allowed to operate and what they're allowed to bring in and what happens if they offer some level of criticism. But what you do have is you've got a government under Abiy Ahmed that has come in. They, I think, released 10,000 political prisoners. They brought people back from overseas. Of course, they made one of the most notable exiled political prisoners the head of the Human Rights Commission that, as I noted, has even been criticizing Abiy Ahmed, who put him into power. You know, they've allowed not only elections that, you know, certainly more real than what the TPLF ever did, except for the one that they lost and then stole. But they also, on top of that, have allowed the first ever vote for a new state since 1995. Now, the right has been in the Constitution. No one's ever been allowed. So there's going to be a new state inside of the southern part of Ethiopia. So again, another attempt to build a framework for national reconciliation, national unity, and to address these issues. You know, you've got the Attorney General that is, doing various things to at least allegedly hold the military accountable. You've got the Board of Elections, which has not only self-criticized in terms of the operation of some elements of the elections and some of the criticisms that have been made against them, but you also have the judicial system and the Supreme Court that actually ruled in favor of some of the opposition parties who criticized the government for doing various things that manipulated the election and so on and so forth. So, okay, yes, I'm sure, you know, I could probably then go on if you want me to for another 2 hours about things that I don't like about the government or things that they aren't doing well or things that they could still be criticized on all these fronts, but you have to then again make the comparison. And what the comparison is that the TPLF refused to address any of these issues and only used blunt force trauma to make sure that none of them ever rose to the level of potentially destabilizing the country. Now, you can say that Abiy Ahmed has to some degree opened up Pandora's box here, and there are a lot of challenges and a lot of issues that are going to be very difficult to resolve. Because when you look at the issue of, you know, how do you have equitable distribution of resources? How do you have equitable distribution of opportunity? How do you divide the pie in a way that makes sense? Who wins? Who loses? In the context of, you know, many, many decades of complicated relationships between people who have, you know, thousands of years of history that, you know, really goes across various different borders of countries that exist today. And I mean, all these just different sort of pieces. You've got thousands of years of ethnic history, cultural and religious cultural heritage that is both overlapping and separate. You've got the juridical reality of differing states being established in different places based on different lines and different things. That's a difficult challenge to solve. There's no doubt about that. But I think that the government does deserve some credit, if for nothing else, at least opening up Pandora's box for these issues to be heard, for them to be addressed, and to stop, you know, using brute force to keep any of these critical questions about the nature of Ethiopian society and the nature of the Horn of Africa from becoming an issue. So I think that, again, many criticisms could be made, but it seems unequivocal that the government of Abiy Ahmed has opened up more democratic space in the country than the TPLF. Now, some people might say that's a low bar, but nevertheless, I think it is relevant in the given what the TPLF did. But nevertheless, I do think it is relevant in terms of how we contextualize, how we talk about it, and how, again, we look at the main issue for people in the United States is you're being asked to sign up to promote a regime that could put serious sanction on Ethiopia, threatening the livelihoods of millions of people, and that could potentially even be used for an attempt at intervention, as we've seen in many other places. And we've seen the impact of that in Syria and Libya and Iraq and all these other countries. So if we're going to say that this is the policy, it seems that it's important for people here in this country to understand that the sort of freedom fighter narrative about the TPLF is not, in fact, true. In fact, it's 100% false. The history proves that it's the opposite of that, and that, in fact, the reason Abiy Ahmed's government is there right now is the struggle of Ethiopian people to have a different form of system. So, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, please.
Well, I just wanted to address the second part of your question.
Yeah, that's how I was going to remind you of it. I thought you were going to end there, but please.
No. it's hard for me to understand the sort of quote-unquote criticisms of Abiy Ahmed as being quote-unquote neoliberal. I mean, we have to take one step back and think, like, what is neoliberal? Now, let me just say at the outset before I get to that, that obviously the government of Abiy Ahmed is a capitalist government, but so is the TPLF. And in fact, even though the TPLF has some quote-unquote Marxist heritage, and I think, you know, I'm using air quotes specifically on that, it's obvious that when they moved into the 1990s, when they moved into the early 2000s, you know, they themselves were promoting sort of market-involved economics with a strong state-led function. And I say that just to say that, quite frankly, this government and the past two governments of Ethiopia have all had relatively developmentalist perspectives, where the role of a strong state to push forward economic development that can, again, expand the size of the pie, maybe not distributed more equitably, but expand the size of the pie, expand the amount of resources and opportunities that are available to the average person is obviously the way to go. I mean, you know, almost all the most economically successful states post-World War II are states with strong state-led development models. And of course, as the TPLF would say, you know, South Korea, countries like that were countries they were certainly looking to in terms of how they were thinking about that. But we know certainly South Korea, even Japan to some degree, obviously okay. China and Vietnam, all had these very strong, Malaysia is another example of that. Singapore, which is, you know, allegedly a capitalist paradise where the state plays a huge role. I mean, you can really see the developmentalist state in Asia is, you know, market activity in many cases, but a strong state-led development. So I think when you put that in the context of Abiy Ahmed's government, now, without a doubt, they are making quite a bit of use of the idea that they want to give more play to the market, that they're looking to pursue market-driven reforms. But I mean, you know, China is also has pursued 40 years of market-driven reforms. China's obviously socialist. China's obviously not neoliberal. Vietnam, since the mid-1980s, has pursued market-driven reforms, obviously is not capitalist, obviously is not neoliberal. I do think the Ethiopian government is capitalist. I do think that they are absolutely looking to give more play to market forces in many realities. But quite frankly, the Ethiopian economy was almost totally controlled by the state. And that's been the case since about 1977. And so ultimately, even with significant privatization, quote unquote, you would still have a system that I would say would be much more akin to a South Korea. If you want to use another example of Japan, which even though I know people think of Japan in a different way, is a very sort of state-managed economy around a handful of the keiretsu. And in South Korea, they call them the Shaibo, in Singapore, where they have like a couple major companies, really one big state-run company that controls a lot of different things. Similar thing to Malaysia. I say all that to say, you know, that is, to me, the types of governments and economies that Ethiopia is most akin to. And I think when you look at some of the things that they're doing, I think it sort of says this. I mean, you know, I've seen some of the people you say are criticizing that are saying, well, you know, they're quote unquote privatizing the telecommunications industry. Well, first and foremost, they are not getting rid of the state-owned telecommunications company. Now, they're all offering up a 40% stake, but a 40% stake of a state-owned company is really like another way of getting a loan. It's really like the government soliciting a loan from private sector influencers, and then the percentage of profits they get is basically the interest on that loan. But it is, in fact, true that the Ethiopian government has offered a license to another company, I believe it's Safaricom out of Kenya, which is a big mobile phone company in Africa, to also operate in Ethiopia. So I guess by the virtue of the criticisms that are being made, having two cell phone companies is neoliberalism. Okay. If that's the way you want to put it, that's fine. Now, I will just say for the record, I do think the Ethiopian government is mistaken in terms of the level of emphasis they put on the role of the market. I do not think that the market is guaranteed to deliver better outcomes than the state in any given circumstance. And I think the success of Ethiopian Airlines, by the way, which is a state-owned company, speaks very directly to that issue. I mean, of course, the entire success of the economies of China and Vietnam also speaks very much that issue, that SOEs, state-owned enterprises, play a major role in, I think, the most successful developmental states post-World War II. And I would certainly, if they were asking me, if they called me on the phone and said, what should we do? I would certainly question some of these, you know, quote-unquote market.
You guys are watching. If you guys are watching,
you know, reach out to me, I guess. I don't, whatever. I don't know if I have those kind of credentials. But the point being is that, you know, there's. I think we have to be a lot more careful with what we say in terms of the nature of neoliberalism. And there's one more point I want to make about this. I think we'll have to see how some of this plays out. But, you know, sort of expanding the role of the market in an almost completely state-led economy doesn't necessarily mean neoliberalism. Now, that is the road that potentially someone could go down. I think there is a battle of ideas in terms of development perspectives in Africa that, you know, the Ethiopian experience speaks very heavily to. But I also want to just make this tertiary point. Even if the Ethiopian regime was neoliberal, does that mean that it's right to sanction them? Does that mean that it's right to try to isolate them in the world economy? Does that mean that it's right to try to plunge millions of people into a terrible situation? I mean, I'll give you an example. Hassan Rouhani, the former president of Iran, the most recent past president of Iran, was a neoliberal. And in fact, like a lot of his economic policies were directly speaking to that. But that certainly didn't make maximum pressure by the Trump regime right. It certainly didn't make the denial of cancer medicine to the people of Iran right. And so I often wonder, like, what is the element of that critique? Because again, the real issue for those of us who are in the United States, for those of us who are in Europe, where our governments are now saying that they might actually take steps that, as we've seen with Iran, as we've seen with Syria, as we've seen with Venezuela, as we've seen with Cuba, could seriously hobble the economy and seriously hurt people's livelihoods, like whether or not that's right or wrong. And I don't really see a reason why that would become right just because I don't agree with the economic policies of Abiy Ahmed, which, as I've said, I don't actually agree with. I don't see how those two things follow. And I don't see what the relationship is between that broader issue. And to me, it's a red herring issue that's being thrown in by people who are looking to disguise who the TPLF really is. They're looking to disguise the fact that whatever you want to say about their internal political policies, that the TPLF was cheek by jowl with imperialism the whole way. They conspired with the Bush administration to destabilize Somalia when it had been stabilized or at least had a unitary government for the first time since 1991. They did that in the mid-2000s. They have also, by the way, commented, I believe it was to the British ambassador, that they wanted to see Gaddafi killed and murdered. They thought he should be murdered. And of course, we know that the issue in Libya was the destruction of one of the strongest, richest African states into, you know, a just hellhole of humanity where slave markets have reemerged and where, by the way, Eritrean migrants have been bearing a lot of that brunt of other sub-Saharan African peoples of this extreme racism. I mean, this is who the TPLF is. They are the best friends of capitalist imperialism coming out of Europe and coming out of the United States on the African continent. And they have been treated as such by the U.S. government over time because of that. Like I said, Obama went there in 2012. And all these human rights people, many of whom are complaining about Abiy Ahmed now, they said, Obama, don't go. No, don't go. You're going to normalize the TPLF regime. And he went.
And he did.
And not only did he normalize it, he said they were democratic and had been freely elected and were one of the best governments in Africa. So, I mean, you just have to sort of look at all of that to say that a lot of this red herring stuff about Abiy Ahmed being a neoliberal is just that. It's designed to throw people off the scent of the fact that one of the most imperialist forces on the continent that was deeply brutal, that was sidelined due to the struggle of its own people, is trying to use a war and a generated humanitarian crisis as a leverage point to force their way back into political leadership of Ethiopia. And that's why they're getting so much backing from the United States in the context of the narrative war.
Well, very well said. And I just want to say two things before I ask you this next question. And the first one is, I really do have only like three questions left. And I apologize to anybody in the Punch Out audience who's watching. I promise we'll get Eugene back to the Punch Out. All right, good to know.
By the time they see this, they will have already heard the Punch Out for the day, the time we were recording.
Yeah, it's true. And then the other thing that I probably should have mentioned closer to the beginning of the show, but for those who have made it this far into it, you know, the sort of the way you can also support not just my show, but Eugene's show, the Punch Out, and all of our excellent content at Breakthrough News is you can become a patron at patreon.com/breakthroughnews. And I just wanted to throw that out there before I get to this next question, which kind of goes off of everything you were just saying, which is, you know, why? Why is the U.S. so biased in this particular situation? Because, you know, like you've mentioned, it's not only threatening sanctions on Ethiopia, which is a huge deal and could really tank the economy, as we've seen happen in other countries, but they also appear to be planning to suspend Ethiopia from what's called the U.S. African Growth and Opportunity Act, which, according to reports, would have a devastating consequences on that country's economy. And already there's been horrible consequences on Ethiopia's economy. Inflation's up. And people really are suffering from, you know, not being able to access basic goods in the areas where there are fighting, as we discussed. But, you know, I understand the U.S. had a very deep relationship with the TPLF for their time in power, but I just can't understand the U.S.'s calculations in this instance. Like, it doesn't make any sense why they would alienate a longtime ally like Ethiopia with so many punitive measures. And it's not like Abiy Ahmed was running around, like, you know, talking about like down with the Yankees. Like, he was still being an ally of America, maybe not as much as the TPLF might have been, but it wasn't like there was really anything you can point to specifically that was going on to make the U.S. so anti-Ethiopia now. And, you know, I've heard some complaints from some people, some sources I've spoken to about the U.S. ambassador to Ethiopia. This woman, Gita Passi, she's very uncooperative regionally with other U.S. officials and other countries in the region. And she's very one-sided in a way that's been surprising to some people who work in the region. And then there's the head of Africa at the National Security Council, this guy, David Diaz, who doesn't even seem to be an Africa expert at all. And then they deployed this guy, Jeffrey Feltman, who has zero experience in Africa, to help mediate the conflict. So on top of, you know, trying to understand, I don't understand what the U.S.'s calculation is here, and I'm not quite sure they even really have one. And, you know, like, it could be a number of things. Like, is it the geostrategic importance of Ethiopia? Is it the China-U.S. Cold War, right? Because Ethiopia does have a big relationship with the U.S., but it also has a growing relationship with China. And, you know, Ethiopian Twitter certainly believes that there's a regime change scheme afoot here coming from the U.S. government that's very planned and very in cooperation with the TPLF. And, you know, I don't blame them. So is that the case? Or is this maybe also a case of like a democratic administration with no real coherent policy that's reacting to media reports and human rights reports, which seem to kind of really be driving it more than even the administration, maybe, rather than these people sort of crafting the policy and the media and the human rights organizations following, because we do know that sometimes policy, you know, is driven by different factors. It can be Congress, it can be the White House, it can be economic interests. It can also be the media and human rights organizations. No. So I guess, I mean, all that said, I'm curious, like, what do you think the, as our friend AOC would say, the why is? Mm-hmm. What's the why?
Well, like, really, what's the- Yeah, I hear you. Yeah, I mean, you know, it's an interesting question. I have to say, I was deeply surprised that the U.S. turned so quickly on the government of Ethiopia, as you said. I mean, Ethiopia had done nothing to provoke the United States. The only thing they had done is say that they want to have better relationship with the United States. Obviously, there's a large diaspora from all of the Horn of Africa countries here in the United States who, you know, play a very important role in culturally enriching a lot of major parts of this country, and, you know, many of whom have become citizens and are voters. So it was not something that I certainly expected. And if you look at some of the initial statements by the U.S. government, they seem to be a little bit surprised that the TPLF would go this far, and then it quickly changed. So, you know, provisionally, I would lay out two factors that I think speak very heavily to what you have laid out. One is the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam issue and the relationship to the politics of the Middle East there. I think the other one is the broader issue of the geostrategic reality of the Horn of Africa and the issue of national independence, sovereignty, and its relationship to imperialism. So, you know, starting on the first issue, you know, the first kind of hint that something was changing perhaps was in 2018, where the Trump administration said, because there's been a long-running issue over this large dam that Ethiopia is putting on the Nile River that will be one of the largest producers, of clean energy anywhere on Earth, and will produce a huge amount of clean energy for not just Ethiopia, but many surrounding countries from South Sudan to potentially Kenya, Somalia, and so on and so forth. So it's a big development project, big for Ethiopia, in many ways big for the planet. And there's a lot of controversy over this with Sudan and Egypt, which are downstream from Ethiopia in the Nile River. There is an agreement, or at least a framework of an agreement, for where a certain amount of mortar will be released every you know, season or whatever into the rest of the river for the rest of these countries to be able to do their agriculture. This is, you know, this happens all the time with dams that are going between two different countries, and also even between and within states here in the United States. It's a huge issue in California every year, right? Which is where water is going to go vis-a-vis population centers and agriculture. So this, not surprisingly, is an issue. Now, Egypt and Sudan said that, well, there's going to be a huge drought if this dam is filled. There is actually no evidence, really, that that is the case. There certainly are some issues in terms of water flow, but there are issues with water flow in the Nile that are related to climate change, like many other rivers all around the world. And there is no concrete evidence that, except perhaps, maybe, during a period of the second and, you know, final filling of the dam, there could be a little disruption, although that has not been proven. But I'm just putting that out there for transparency's sake, but that almost everything that's actually been determined about this so far, and including reports that came from this past year where the dam is already being filled up, is that the impact is actually nil. And in fact, the greater challenge to Egypt vis-a-vis the Nile River is the issues surrounding climate change that are affecting the whole Earth, the whole planet, and certainly are affecting the Horn of Africa. So it's a canard issue that there is going to be a loss of water or economic dynamism for Egypt or for Sudan, but nevertheless, especially the government of Egypt has just picked up that cudgel. Despite the sort of scientific information, they have decided to go a different way, to claim that Ethiopia is doing something terrible. They've had war games with Sudan. I don't know 100% what is motivating the government of Egypt in taking this hardline position. I don't want to get into that. But what's important about this is in 2018, because many of the various frameworks and formats to address this, the African Union, IGAD, which is a group of countries in the region, those had all failed. And so the U.S., Trump personally said, I am willing to do it. Like, I will intervene, I will mediate. But then rather than mediate, he actually just took 100% the side of Egypt. And yeah, that surprised many people, because it was like, well, wait a second. Like, first and foremost, you're a mediator, not a determinant. But also, like, at the very least, there are two sides of this issue. And from at least what I've seen, it certainly seems that Egypt is not being truthful about what the impact of this is. So you'd think that it would be more even-handed or whatever. So that was already a raised eyebrow. Like, well, that is something. So I think that issue is important, though, Because when you think of the context of the pivot to Asia, one of the main U.S. pieces policy-wise since the Obama administration has been how to reduce the footprint militarily in terms of the Middle East, and how to introduce sort of a balance of power politic so that they can introduce more of their military power into encircling China. And it's obviously something that has been behind a lot of the moves. Obama, I believe, actually openly said this once or twice. But saying all that, Egypt is obviously one of the key pillars of the security architecture of imperialism in the Middle East. Obviously, it maintains really the key role of the blockade of Gaza, because Israel can do whatever they want to do. Egypt can do whatever they want to do. They choose to connive with imperialism and Zionism to keep the people of Gaza starving. But funny how that de facto blockade doesn't get denounced in the same way what's allegedly happening in Ethiopia is. But setting that aside, obviously, Egypt plays a major issue and a major role there in that broader security architecture. And also, Sudan has recently been brought into this security architecture. Sudan, of course, is a long time under the previous government, which, again, many negative things you could say about it. But one of the things you can say about the previous government is that they were staunch supporters of the Palestinian national liberation struggle. And so when there was a mass protest in Sudan that brought that government down, very important protest involving many progressive forces, including a lead role by the Communist Party, the Sudanese Communist Party and others, then a new government comes in. We can talk more about that later. But long story short, they're still under all these sanctions from the era of Omar al-Bashir. And so the U.S. basically goes to them and says, hey, we'll drop all the sanctions, which of course is important because you're a new government, you're coming in, you want to develop your country. But they were like, got to drop Palestinians, got to pick up Israel. So the new Sudanese government, they did exactly that. They became enemies of the Palestinians and they became friends of the state of Israel, and they're now in it. So you put that context in of the U.S. wanting to have a sort of balance of power politic that more or less mimics what we've seen in terms of the imperialist status quo in the Middle East, but with a smaller footprint. And it makes sense to me that you would certainly then be thinking, well, I'm not too happy about anybody, even my friends, who maybe seem to be upsetting the apple cart there. And I mean, the possibility, I truly hope this does not happen, of potential war between Egypt and Ethiopia, Egypt and Sudan and Ethiopia, and the destabilization of the whole region, and what all that could mean, obviously would throw a monkey wrench into this broader U.S. security architecture. So I think that's one factor of why the U.S. has been so hostile to Abiy Ahmed's government and so willing to push the TPLF back into a position of power, of prominence, of influence, because I think they believe that the TPLF, which has a long history of collaboration with U.S. imperialism to the extent of destabilizing countries like Somalia and other terrible things that they have done, that they would be more willing ultimately to find an accommodation that Egypt and Sudan think is right vis-a-vis the issue of the dam, perhaps even let the issue of the dam go. I mean, who exactly knows? I mean, it was a project they started, but who really knows? I think that's one broader piece of it. And I think the connected piece of that, which is the willingness of the TPLF to match its aspirations to the aspirations of U.S. imperialism, is the issue of independence. So, you know, I brought up the issue of Iran earlier, and I've also brought up the issue of the Middle East. So I think, again, when we look at the sort of character of the government of Iran, it's not, you know, Cuba. It's not some socialist revolutionary government seeking to bring right and equity to the whole world in the face of brutal humiliation and inequality that capitalism and imperialism has brought to the world. It's not that. But it is a country that says, like, we want to basically do our own thing. We want to work with Europe. We want to work with America. We want to work with China. We want to have our style of Islamic government. We want to relate to countries around us in the way that we want to relate to them, and not in the way that the United States says. And we don't want to be subordinate to the interest of Israel and the United States. We don't want to have to, you know, hold back our economy. I mean, you think about Iran and the issue of missiles. You know, one of the reasons that people really confuse this issue is ballistic missile technology is also satellite technology. So when the United States is saying, well, you have to not just limit your infrastructure and your electrical power, which of course there's nuclear power that they use to power things in Iran, but that you also have to limit your scientific technological ability to succeed and prosper in the 21st century, you can see how that's that people don't like that and end up in an oppositional stance. But that is the precondition that U.S. imperialism puts on every single region of the world, is that you can only exist as long as you're willing to fill a role inside of the system that leaves you subordinate to us. Now, there are different roles, and there are different roles that are certainly better than others. Some countries are much more deeply victimized than others. Like, you know, South Korea is playing a role, but there's a much higher living standard in South Korea than there is in, say, Sudan or Chad or, you know, any of these other African allies of the United States. But you have to be able to play that role. But like I said, the point I made about Iran is an important point because it speaks to the fact that in the 21st century, the fraying around the edges of the imperialist consensus has meant more countries and more regions, whatever their sort of, you know, socio-political content, are developing stronger, more powerful economies and also have a lot of economic potential, and they don't want to fit into the role that the U.S. has ascribed for them. The same thing could be said of Turkey. I mean, obviously, Erdogan is one of the most execrable leaders of any country on earth and, you know, is doing terrible things to the masses of people there in Turkey, but somehow he's in this major issue with the U.S. and Europe, and it's basically because he doesn't want to conform 100% to what they want him to conform to, and, you know, he wants to have his own power politics in the broader region that gives the elites of Turkey, or at least the elites who are behind the AKP party, you know, a bigger role in the broader world economy. People want a bigger slice of the pie, and they don't want U.S. imperialism to tell them what to do in every possible way. And you know, we could get into this, but I do think that has something to do with the nature of the African Union negotiations in the Ethiopia issue. But to circle back around, the Horn of Africa is obviously one of the most geostrategic regions on the planet Earth. I've said this before. I think I said this on our last interview about this. Just remember what happened when that ship blocked the Suez Canal.
Yeah.
And it was like a massive crisis for the whole world.
Yeah.
This is basically the area that the Horn is in, is this crossroads of the world. And for thousands of years, it's been one of the main crossroads. I mean, the Horn of Africa, and also, you know, some of what is now Yemen, which was controlled by the Kingdom of Aksum at the time, was in fact the key link between the trade between the Roman Empire and India. And in and of itself was a very rich society because it was really representing these crossroads of the world. So since thousands, you know, 1,000 years ago, this has been one of the key crossroads of world commerce. And now as everything is shifting economically a little bit back more towards the Eurasian landmass, then I think you can certainly see that the issue of the Horn of Africa, whether it be international commerce, whether it be the politics of the Middle East, in which it is obviously in some ways kind of a part of that sort of broader Southwest Asia piece when you look at it on the map, and so on and so forth, then you can see that an independent state that emerges there, I mean, there's actually nothing in the cards that says it would be negative or hostile towards the United States. In fact, I think if you look at the sort of record of the various governments in the region, I don't think they would be looking to do anything other than cooperate, you know, for a mutual benefit. But it creates the same problem that Iran creates, because Iran wants to cooperate with the United States for a mutual benefit. They're desperate to cooperate with the United States on the economic issues and other things like that. That's why they were willing to give up so much in the Iran deal, which was a truly concessionary deal. But that doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if you want to work with us. It doesn't matter if you want to be friends. If you aren't willing to accept the ascribed role as a friend that you must have, I can't deal with you. And the fact that you may try to independently do something or exert your own power over mine so that I cannot determine the course of events in critical geostrategic regions. And when you go back to 1992 and the Wolfowitz Doctrine, which has governed U.S. foreign policy after the fall of the Soviet Union, that is in fact the goal, is to maintain strategic control and hegemony over every important strategic region of the earth. So anyone who might try to do something different becomes a challenge, which brings me to one major issue, and that is the Ethiopia-Eritrea peace deal. I believe that that plays a major issue in why the United States has been so willing to take the TPLF side, essentially, and really try to pressure the Ethiopian government on that issue. There's a long history of war, and this was a massively historic peace deal that was made between these two nations, and really, I think, raised the hopes of people all across the Horn of Africa about the possibility for what it could mean to have more unification in the broader region, economically, culturally, and so on and so forth. But of course, Eritrea and the United States, deeply at odds in many ways. Eritrea certainly has been one of the main forces in the broader Horn of Africa region that already, even as a small nation, even as a developing nation, has been resistant to unfettered rule and determination of the United States of the politics of the Horn of Africa, has been a critic on that front, that has also been a staunch critic on the international front of the, you know, U.S.-led international order, if you will, the so-called rules-based international order. They've pointed out consistently how that is sort of enforced poverty for many of the nations of the world, especially nations of Africa. And so the possibility that there could be more unity in the Horn, which there's many things we could say about U.S. policy for the past 40 or so years in the Horn of Africa, but the one thing we can say for absolute certain is that the U.S. has tended to always favor fragmentation and division over unity.
To weaken,
Yeah. For an obvious reason, when you speak to the issue of independence and the ability to leverage your own power in geostrategic regions. And I think the fact that the new Ethiopian government was willing to sideline, you know, the Friends of Imperialism, was willing to sign a peace deal with Eritrea, which the TPLF never would have done. They waged two wars against them, and also then start to work with the president of Somalia to create a new dispensation in the Horn of Africa that isn't hostile to the West. I think it's important for people to know that, but is in favor of a stronger sense of self-determination, a stronger sense of national independence, a stronger sense of the ability to operate economically and socially the way you want to, that poses a serious danger to, I think, the U.S. imperialism attempt to control the region.
Can I ask you something with regard to that? I have an American friend who made a stupid liberal argument to me, and I'd love for you to respond to this, because respect to the Ethiopia-Eritrea peace deal that Abiy Ahmed won a Nobel Peace Prize for making, you know, I was kind of like talking to this friend about reasons why the U.S. is doing this, like why, basically the question I asked you. And I was like, well, maybe it's this peace deal. And the response was like, that's really stupid. The peace deal won the Nobel Peace Prize. You wouldn't win a Nobel Peace Prize for something the West doesn't want or is opposed to, which I thought was a really stupid argument. But can you just very quickly tell me why that's a stupid argument? Because I know this friend will be watching.
No, of course. Well, I mean, you know, Martin Luther King won the Nobel Peace Prize. I don't think
Thank
he was
you.
The most beloved by U.S. capitalists. They actually assassinated him 4 years later. I don't really know who controls the Nobel Prize. I think it certainly serves an ideological purpose. But I think, you know, we can just see much more clearly. I mean, there's been criticism of the peace deal in the West from the beginning on a range of different levels. But two, I think it's just clear when you look at the context and the politics of the region that the United States blames Eritrea for everything that happens in the Horn of Africa. You know, it's Al-Shabaab, that's Eritrea. East Sudan, that's Eritrea. Anything negative in Ethiopia, that's Eritrea. Everything is some hidden hand of Eritrea manipulating everything for negative purposes.
Right?
Yeah, it has that kind of reality. And there's a lot of complex thought behind that. But when you look at that level of demonization that's been put on the country, the demonization that's put on the country by many other nations, the derogatory statements that have been made about Eritrea over the years by many different individuals and organizations, it's clear that there is not an era of good feeling between the U.S. and Eritrea, that even though they have relations, you know, they are cool in many ways, and that the main reason for that is the U.S. has not been able to find a way to integrate Eritrea into the overall imperialist system. They dance to the beat of their own drummer, and they refuse to be integrated only on the terms of the United States into the broader world economy. And I think when you look at the fact that the TPLF was so heavily in favor of destroying Eritrea, isolating them on an international basis, then there's this peace deal, and the U.S. is then backing the TPLF, who under sort of really their own reality is saying, we want to return to either leadership of the country or veto-style power over the direction of the country, that they wouldn't then be thinking, well, one of the subsets of this is going to be a rollback of unity between Eritrea and Ethiopia. Because without a doubt, if the TPLF was to gain a significant role in the government, that would be something that they would absolutely demand. So why would you be pushing a force that's going to do that? Even if it wasn't your number one goal, if you weren't basically okay with that. And I think that they're more than basically okay with that. I personally believe, and to address your friend specifically, that it is exactly what they want. And it's exactly the thing they fear, because it is the axis of the idea of independence inside of the Horn. It's the axis of what, you know, could possibly be a more independent dispensation, to have all these countries working more closely together and in a way that would open up more economic growth. But certainly, again, just given the history of Eritrea, that would open up a political perspective as well in the context of greater unity on the Horn that starts to favor, you know, a perspective that's more leaned towards not only the development of that region, but the development of the African continent, and in a way that is not along the lines that imperialism in the United States or Europe would want to dictate.
Yeah. And, you know, I think that it's also a good opportunity to maybe, we talked a little bit about Eritrea the last episode we did on this issue of Ethiopia. And I think it'd be a great opportunity for you to maybe talk a little bit about, it's because it's not just the fact that Eritrea is like the, or no, okay, let me put it this way. Eritrea is independent. The U.S. opposes that. That's why it's so demonized, as you explained. But I think its independence is also dangerous in some ways for U.S. interests, because because it hasn't been subjected to a lot of the kinds of schemes, the sort of capitalist neoliberal schemes that the U.S. has imposed, or imperialist schemes that the U.S. has imposed on a lot of the rest of Africa, it actually has some better social indicators compared to its peers. So I wanted to give you a chance to maybe talk a little bit about that, because people don't get to hear about Eritrea from this context. Only ever bad Eritrea. They're, you know, soldiers are everywhere just committing genocide. That's all we hear, literally.
That is all you hear. The other thing you hear is that it's the North Korea of the African continent, which is, you know, I mean, it's meant as a slander, but it's also such a backhanded slander to North Korea. I mean, the reality is, you know, compared to, say, Chad, the average person living in Chad, living in, you know, Pyongyang would be like living in a paradise. So, you know, I actually think that's, I just wanted to note that at the outset, that, you know, you can see Eritrea is more broadly linked to this attempt by Western political forces to demonize nations that are viewed to be aberrant and deviant from the, you know, so-called rules-based international order in any significant way. Cuba is the world's worst dictatorship. North Korea is the world's worst dictatorship. Eritrea is the world's worst dictatorship. Venezuela
so
is the
strange.
World's. Yeah,
only
everyone
the
is the world's worst dictatorship, only if you hate the United States. But right across the ocean there, from the sea, from Eritrea, is the Gulf, where, you know, the entire place is based on forced slave-like labor and massive income inequality and cutting people's heads off and hands off for the most basic of crimes. But that doesn't make you some sort
they're
of
reforming.
Evil pariah.
Eugene, they're reforming.
Right.
They're reforming.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and there you have it. Like, but anyway, I say all that to say that I think it's important to recognize, and there are a number of things you could say, but I think one thing that I think is worth noting in terms of, you know, the role Eritrea plays and certainly the attitude that imperialism has taken towards it, certainly in the context of this conflict, is exactly what was said, I think it was just about a month ago, by the Eritrean representative in the conference of the LDCs, the least developed countries. And they made a really important point in the Eritrean contribution that I think speaks very much to this. They said in the entire time, I believe it's 50 years, that the LDC group has existed. And it exists in the context of, you know, a range of international frameworks. And the entire time the LDC group has existed, only two countries have graduated from the least developed countries. And the Eritrean representative says, why is that? And they go on to say many other things. And I think it's worth reading. It's a very short thing, their presentation there. But I think that in and of itself is key. And you could also see this in the contribution they made to the United Nations General Assembly this year, where they are very clearly stating that the reason some countries are developed and some countries are not is not random. It's not by accident. It's in fact by the deliberate policy of the powerful nations, and that they manipulate their power and their control over so many critical levers of the global economy and the broader international community in order to keep this enforced poverty, this enforced underdevelopment as the state of affairs for the whole world. And so obviously, for the point of view of the United States, they hate all countries who point this out. And Eritrea, even though it's never talked about, is one of these countries that points this out. And I think that's one of the main reasons that they have been demonized, isolated, and why, of course, there is a deep fear by the United States and others about what it would mean for Eritrea to play a bigger role, not just in the Horn of Africa, but if they're playing a bigger role in the Horn of Africa and in the state of Africa, and as we can see now as part of the Friends of the UN Charter group started by Venezuela and China, it also starts to break their isolation and allow them to receive more assistance from countries that don't want to tell them exactly what to do. Because one of the main principles in Eritrea is that they don't take aid that doesn't conform to their own development approach, which is to produce, you know, to focus really mainly on the fundamentals and the foundation of the base and build up from there. So to, you know, put sustainability on the table, to put food sovereignty on the table as a major issue, the development of basic education, the development of technical and higher education, the development of healthcare systems. And, you know, they've done quite a bit in 30 years of independence. And I want to speak to this in terms of the indicators. But I think it's also important to note the critique that they themselves have raised up about this issue, which is important, not just to Eritrea, but to Venezuela, to Cuba, to other countries that are, you know, developing countries facing big economic challenges, is that it's not just the issue of being underdeveloped. It's that anyone who chooses a development path that, again, doesn't speak to that ascribed role of friend, where you may be seeking you're not seeking enemies in the United States, but you're seeking to improve the living standards and the livelihood of your country and your region in a way that will move you out of the ascribed underdeveloped role that they've set for you, that is, even if you haven't even accomplished it yet, that is a huge challenge, because it's an ideological challenge to the idea that neocolonialism is the only way that developing nations can approach the way that they engage with the world and the way that they engage with the world economy. Now, I hope you don't mind I look at my notes here for a second, because I want to get this right, because I do think
Please.
That You know, this is an important issue in terms of how you look at country, because if you're going to say someone is the worst of the worst, and that's why I raised up that issue of North Korea, some would say DPRK, compared it to Cuba, compared it to Venezuela, because there's a similar issue here where the countries are listed as the worst of the worst and all these different things. And then when you actually start to look at the numbers, they in fact are not the worst of the worst. So just throw a few things out here for you that I think people would be relevant. And again, sorry for looking at my notes, but again, I want to get it right about Eritrea here. Eritrea has a higher literacy rate than Pakistan, Nigeria, Egypt, Mali, Niger, and Sudan. They have a higher life expectancy than Nigeria, South Africa, Angola, Zambia, Malawi, and Mozambique. Now, I want to just reiterate some of what I just said. In the first two, that they have a higher literacy rate than Nigeria, that they have a higher life expectancy than Nigeria. Nigeria is one of the richest nations on the planet Earth. There is no reason why people are living in abject poverty all across that country. And that right there should tell you something, because Nigeria is one of America's best friends on the African continent and has been for some time. And their social indicators are shameful. Their use of resources, the income inequality, the looting, the kleptocracy, shameful conditions for people of Nigeria. Lower life expectancy than Eritrea, lower literacy rate, and you never hear anything that's said about Eritrea said about Nigeria. And that's not a huge knock on other African countries, but I think it's important. Also, Pakistan, you know, Pakistan obviously has many development issues, but lower literacy rate than Eritrea, lower life expectancy than Eritrea. When you look at access to improved drinking water, this is a big issue in Eritrea. It's one of the main things that they're working on is access to water, access to more sanitation facilities. I think it's something like 54% of villages now or communities are open defecation free, which is, you know, a big thing that was celebrated this year by you know, some of the UN agencies that Eritrea had accomplished. And that's a big thing. So improved drinking water, that's a huge issue. That's something that they're focusing on. So more people in Eritrea have access to improved drinking water. Well, safely managed water. That's actually, this is a different one. Similar sort of stat, but more people in Eritrea have access to safely managed water, so clean water, than Nigeria, Pakistan, Congo, Brazzaville, and Peru. So again, there you go. Yet again, you look at the issue of infant mortality. There's a lower infant mortality in Eritrea than in Nigeria, India, Pakistan, Mali, Zambia, Benin, Burkina Faso, Sudan, Uganda, and Chad. And there is a higher employment to population ratio, which is basically the number of people who are of working age that are actually working rather than just sitting around idle and unemployed than Nigeria, South Africa, Pakistan, El Salvador, and Colombia. So I am and not
when
the
you
first
mentioned a lot of that's sorry, a lot of the countries that you're mentioning are very strong US allies. Again, yeah. I just think that's a really important thing to note, but continue.
There are also more primary age school children in school in Eritrea than in Pakistan or Nigeria. But I say all that to say, not that everything's perfect. I would not say that. The government would not say that. And in fact, I mean, if you don't believe me, you can just go look at the government-produced documents from Eritrea, where they actually talk quite a bit, not just about their successes, but about their challenges, about the, you know, attempts to address climate change, have sustainability, and have food sovereignty in a country that, you know, in fact, because of the nature of the geography, only has limited access to water. They've built something like 700 dams, by the way, since 1991 to help manage water and manage agriculture. About the need, you know, you read an article to say, well, we've done a great job bringing in more doctors, but we still haven't done enough. So no one is claiming that that it's not a developing nation. It's obviously in the LDC group. It's growing from a very low base. It's only 30 years old as a country. It's emerging from almost 30 more years of essentially guerrilla-based conflict, and it's in an area that already was economically depressed due to the nature of the structure of the global economy, and that in and of itself faces its own, you know, relative challenges to that sort of geographical reality. So no one is trying to make any, you know, wild claims here. But when you look at what they have done in that 30 years, obviously around some of the key human social indicators that we look to all around the world to determine how people are doing, they're doing significantly better than countries that are best friends with the United States and receive huge sums of money and all sorts of trade preferences from them that Eritrea is totally excluded from. And what is the difference? The difference to me seems very clear that Eritrea is pursuing a development path that is based on more equitable development, based on a more social justice type approach to not having huge income inequality and huge differences between the rural areas and the urban areas, that's seeking to build a strong foundation to grow a strong economy up from. And we've seen, if you look at a country like, say, China, I mean, that's a big sense of why China is successful now, is they spent the first 40 or so years of the country building up a very strong foundation and a very strong base. And, you know, ultimately, these types of politics and politics that they're willing to call this out on the international stage in terms of what is really going on in the broader situation, I think is something the U.S. hates. But I think it deserves much more credit. It deserves much more focus. There is much more that I think people should see and know about what's going on there. And there's a lot to be said for other African nations that are at a similar level of development, other nations around the world, but especially in Africa, which is a continent that has been forced into brutal, humiliating neocolonialism, about how to really build up an equitable economic, social substructure as we go into the 21st century. I think many of the questions there, you know, you look at the other small country that's considered, you know, relatively successful economically is Rwanda. Rwanda is the opposite, right? It's sort of the U.S. imperialist satrapy approach to what 21st century African development should be. I think Eritrea is offering some different answers to some similar questions that I think deserves a closer look. And I think, again, as you can see from those social indicators, already with almost none of the similar resources compared to a country like Nigeria that's ultra rich, none of the serious resource, similar resources as many of these other countries that are getting unlimited aid from the United States and still delivering terrible social indicators that they've been able to transcend that and get over some of these in important areas. And I think that deserves to be said and it deserves to be recognized.
So I think ultimately this is like the U.S. scramble for Africa. Maybe that's what we should call this video. Because that's what this goes to, is like the trying to control this very important geostrategic region of the world. And if they can't control it, they'll chop it up and destabilize it. And that's what we're seeing happen now. And so that, I think that's a good place to close on, in a way, is, you know, we've talked about this before, how the media, I mean, privately, we've talked about how the media is hyping up Ethiopia being a failed state and, you know, disintegrating. But you told me that you think that's quite sensationalist. So I'm wondering if maybe you can elaborate on that and tie it into what you think is going to happen with this conflict, if not that, because that does seem like what the West at least is implying they want. Is a disintegrated Ethiopia. So I'll give you that to sort of close on.
Yeah, no, well, I appreciate that. I think it is sensationalist. I mean, there are obviously serious challenges to the structural integrity, if you will, of the broader Horn of Africa region. I've already outlined a lot of the reasons why that is the case. I think obviously in the context of serious disputes, the possibility of the country unraveling is not unknown. Obviously, a major expansion of the war, opens up the opportunity of it spilling into other parts of Ethiopia, other countries, other nations. So I don't want to downplay the issue as if it's not relevant, as if it's not actually very important in terms of the possibilities of what could take place there and what the sort of worst case scenario is. But I also would say I think there are important sort of counter forces there that are playing a role. I mean, again, you saw in the elections that the Prosperity Party was able to get a fair amount of support. You saw groups like the ONLF that refused to participate in the elections but said, we're not going back to armed struggle. We're going to continue to try to find a peaceful way to resolve our differences. You see the peace deal between Ethiopia and Eritrea. So there are also a lot of things that we have seen that speak towards the possibility of more unity on the Horn and the fact that there are tens of millions of people who would like to see more unity on the Horn of Africa and don't want to see it ripped apart in a range of, ethnic conflicts and the establishment of, little tiny small states constantly warring with one another or whatever it may be. And so I think that to say that it's sort of preordained that this is only going in one way, I think is It's obviously, I think, too early to say, although I do think there is a worst case scenario that I think everyone should be trying to avoid at all costs, because there's no disintegration scenario that isn't, truly one of the world's worst humanitarian disasters that we may have even ever seen, given the number of people on the Horn and so on and so forth. But where is it going? I don't know. I mean, militarily, it doesn't really look like the TPLF is in a great position. They seem to be surrounded on pretty much all sides. The level of enthusiasm in Ethiopia, sort of the rally around the flag effect that we have seen from not only the war itself, but the way the international media has totally distorted and isolated and demonized Ethiopia, the way the U.S. and even many figures in the United Nations have piled on with that. And I think there's more now unity towards the aims of finding a way to end this. And even from those who are more critical of the government in the country, not feeling the TPLF did the right thing. Who knows? With military operations, you never really know what's going to happen. I think there's a lot of different pieces like that. But I think that there is, like I said at the beginning of this, something of an in-game aspect to this. And the way the coming offensives succeed or don't succeed on either side will determine what it is. I mean, the sort of amateur military scientist in me would say that the only real chance the TPLF has is a breakout attack from the southern part of where they are right now straight into Addis Ababa and to try to overthrow the government and maybe destroy crazy. The military with the set piece battle. I think when you look at the way that they've driven their forces, that seems to be the sort of direction they're going in, and certainly their own statements that they would march all the way to Addis if they had to and overthrow the government. And I think the reality is what they want to do is not be marginalized. You know, even if they were to be able to maintain themselves in Tigray as a guerrilla fighting force, that would not be the outcome that they want. So it seems to me the only way for them to win is to launch a big, bold offensive that can change the stakes of it. And if that doesn't work, I think it's probably over for them. And I think obviously the Ethiopian government and their allies and you know, different regional forces, and also at least potentially in Eritrea, I don't know what role Eritrea may or may not play in any future offensives. That's certainly not clear. And, you know, we'd have to see, but let's just assume they do potentially play some role, that, you know, there's a hammer and an anvil effect as well in terms of the way the forces are arrayed, in terms of the access they have to war material, the ability to be resupplied and things like that. So again, these things can go many different ways. Obviously, the thing the TPLF has said for a long time is they're going to blast their way to the Sudanese border and open up their own corridor to bring in, you know, more supplies and so on and so forth. We know that the country head of the International Organization of Migration, part of the United Nations, who was recently removed from the country due to unsanctioned interviews, quote unquote. Some of that audio was released by Jeff Pierce. But just to finish that point really quickly, you know, one of the accusations that she had made in that audio was that the TPLF was trying to have Eritrean refugees exiled from Saudi Arabia and to form them up into some sort of force in Rwanda or something like that. I don't know how true that is, but the point I'm making is just to say the military thing could go either way. So I don't want to say how it's going to end. And, you know, there are different things that could happen on both sides. But I do think that this next round of fighting has an in-game feel to it. And that really, I think, whatever the resolution is here will speak very heavily to what the resolution of the issue is itself, whether or not the TPLF is able to come back either into power or at least with a strong veto leverage position, and we will see, or whether or not the Ethiopian government will be able to prevail and suppress them ultimately. Whether or not there could be peace negotiations, I don't know. The TPLF from the very beginning has completely rejected the African Union mediation. The main mediation is the African Union mediation. The Ethiopian government is willing to work with the African Union. And as you can see, if you follow the Twitter account of Abiy Ahmed, he has, you know, had many different interactions with many important African leaders, including many U.S. allies. And I think when you look at the U.N. General Assembly this year, I think a lot of the statements you can see, certainly by Felix Tshisekedi, who's the head of DRC, also the president of Ghana, neither of which I think are worth anything at all, quite frankly, and are, you know, heavily tied to a Western agenda. But I think their attempts to speak with a more pan-African vein and to demand African solutions to African problems, which is also what the Kenya, which is a member of the Security Council right now, what they've been saying about the African Union negotiations, I think those people have their own agenda. I think their agenda, quite frankly, is they just want a bigger role in the neo-colonial dispensation on the African continent. And I think they view the issue of African Union-led peace deals and security initiatives and so on and so forth in that vein, that, like, even if we agree on what needs to be done, we want to be doing more of the leading and we want you to play more of a background. I think that's not really Pan-Africanism. I think it's actually, you know, the same type of neocolonialism that undermined Kwame Nkrumah and the Bamako group in the early 1960s. And I did a lot of talking about that on the Empire Files with Abby Martin when we talked about Africa, if you want to see more about that. So I think that they're cynical. I think that they're, you know, not actually trying to do anything good. But I do think that that peace agreement and that peace deal does speak to those pressures and those realities. And I think that the TPLF has sort of seen that. I think they've seen that these African nations aren't that, you know, friendly to their, I mean, they were certainly friendly with some of them when they were in power, but they aren't that friendly to the idea that you can just, like, start an insurgency and take over a country militarily. I think they see how that can blow back on them. And the fact that the U.S. is supporting that, I think they probably would prefer to see something that looks a little bit more even-handed, more African-led, quote unquote. But that's not good for the TPLF. When you look at what took place in terms of the U.S. announcement where they were saying there may be sanctions, the easiest way to look at what that meant was that the Ethiopian government rejected it categorically, and the TPLF, even though they were criticized in a couple lines, said that this is perfect and this is exactly what we wanted to see, and we're hoping to see more of a role from the United States in international mediation. So they know that they can only succeed in a mediation effort to the extent that the U.S. is playing a key role in that mediation effort, hence why they're doing everything possible to use the humanitarian demonization of Ethiopia as a leverage point to push the United States to more aggressively push itself into any sort of negotiations to potentially end the conflict, to use sanctions or other things like that as a weapon against the Ethiopian government, to push them into some form of negotiations that are more led by the United States, where the AU is a little bit more sidelined and where the TPLF gets a broader agenda. I don't think that's necessarily going to happen, though, and thus I think it's more likely that the fighting itself will be the determinant of how this thing ends, which I think is very, very unfortunate and very tragic for the people of the Horn of Africa, the people of Ethiopia, the people of Tigray, all of whom who have been caught in this terrible vice of the TPLF, a 30-year brutal kleptocratic government that couldn't deal with the fact that its own people sidelined it and decided to launch a war under false pretexts in order to find a way to get back into the game. I think it's very unfortunate. I think, again, just to reiterate and just to close on this, for those of us watching in the United States, for those of us watching in Europe, those are really the stakes of this conflict, is that in our own name, the governments of these countries are saying that they are going to enact a policy that could be deeply harmful and detrimental to the people of Ethiopia, just like we've seen in Iran, Venezuela, Cuba, Libya, Syria, Iraq, and so on and so forth, of sanctions and potential possibility for intervention. And it's being done on a basis that is not, in fact, true, and where there are many distortions, lies, and decontextualizations that have created a narrative which makes that kind of thing seem logical. Why would you not sanction these people if they were doing this? Why would you not do that, trying to speak to the human impulse of anyone to try to intervene when it seems like something is going wrong? But as we said in this interview, the facts of that and the context of that speak to a very different reality that show that not only the policies of sanctions and the policies of intervention are malign, but that in fact the return of the TPLF to power in Ethiopia would be a malign goal, given what they did for 30 years.
Well, Eugene, thank you so much for coming on once again to break all this down for us. Again, my Breakthrough News colleague, Eugene Puryear, we co-host a live stream together every Thursday, The Freedom Side, from 3 to 5 p.m. Eastern. He's also the host of the excellent daily podcast, The Punch Out. Thank you again for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me, Rania.